The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Prayer at the beginning, as you kind of took us on a little tour around the world there. And I really do believe that what we're talking about this weekend will make a difference, could make a difference in the world. A family moves to a new city. The decision to move was made for financial reasons. The father believing there were much greater opportunities for prosperity in the new location. After they arrived, they discovered that the cultural surroundings of their new home are fraught with obstacles for their family and for their spiritual well-being. While the economic opportunities are there, the city turns out to be a moral cesspool. Unwilling or unable to relocate, the family suffers horribly, resulting in the death of the mother, the loss of their home as they flee in terror of physical violence, and eventually sexual sin between daughters and father. Ken Myers relates this story in his book, All God's Children, Blue Suede Shoes, and he goes on to say, this could be the outline for a Sweeps Week miniseries on one of the networks, but this scenario is actually one of the earliest recorded instances of the effects of a culture on the lives of individuals and families. It is, of course, the story of Lot and his family. Finally, I'd like to have us think together about what kind of music would be good to listen to and enjoy. I really want you to know, too, that it's really difficult to cover the entire subject. And so what we're doing is we're taking little pieces here and there, and not all of it is going to flow well, but hopefully issues that concern us and we can think about together tonight. I also really want your feedback. I've been on a journey in this subject and really do want your comments and response. And I hope to leave time at the end for those. So listen and prepare to respond. What is culture? George Barna, in a recent survey among more than 6,000 adults, compared the lives of self-described born-again Christians and non-Christians. The two groups were measured on 66 different core religious beliefs and practices. The results show that the self-described Christians were demonstrably different on only 9 of the 66 issues. Even more revealing was that the comparison of the two groups on 65 non-religious factors, things like core values, common moral behaviors and attitudes regarding truth and ethics, the Christians were indistinguishable from the non-Christians on all 65 factors. Barna goes on to say that Christians don't live differently because they don't think differently. They may know the stories and the characters of the Bible, but these stories don't act as a moral and intellectual grid or filter for their thoughts and actions. From the results of the survey, we can make several observations about culture. Number one, culture grows out of a worldview. Culture grows out of a worldview. The fundamental beliefs held by people in a society determine their patterns of living. When the lives of Christians do not differ significantly from the lives of non-Christians around them, we have occasion to ask what they really believe. We need to examine our beliefs. Number two, our perception of culture is transparent. We don't even see it. It's so much a part of our thinking and experience that we don't consciously think about it. Let me give an illustration of that. Several years ago, I visited Haiti, and there heard the story of a local pastor who had spent some time in the States. It was a native Haitian pastor, and he tells a story about driving through his father's farm one day. And there was a little creek running through the farm, and as he pulled across the bridge, he noticed there was a good-sized group of people down in the creek waiting around. And he noticed as he looked that they were stripping the grass in the creek. They were stripping fish eggs off the grass and eating them. And there were enough of them in there, everybody grabbing and pulling and stripping the grass, that they were trampling the grass completely, just turning the creek into a muddy mess and the grass being trampled and all the fish eggs being stripped off. And he jumped out of his truck and he said, "Stop, stop. If you do this, there'll be no food for tomorrow." Makes sense. They looked at him and shrugged him off and continued the carnage. They wouldn't stop. Well, I heard that story. I marveled at their stupidity. Why wouldn't you think about tomorrow? Well, this even happened during the U.S. imposed fuel embargo, and shortages were everywhere. The country was in a real difficulty. But these people saw no compelling reason to plan for tomorrow. In fact, it didn't even seem to be a rational or significant consideration for them. They had a different worldview. What seemed inconceivable to me wasn't even a category for them. Number three, culture is difficult to define. We just don't go outside and encounter culture. We may go outside and hear a song, see a billboard, read a novel, but we don't encounter culture. We don't consciously experience the whole. T.S. Eliot has observed that culture is the product of a variety of more or less harmonious activities, each pursued for its own sake. The artist must concentrate upon his canvas, the writer or poet upon his typewriter, the civil servant upon the just settlement of the particular problems as they present themselves upon his desk, each according to the situation in which he finds himself. So how then do we examine culture? If we can't see it, it's difficult to define. How do we go about examining it? Simply stated, culture is the expression of the beliefs and behaviors of a group of people. We can learn about culture by examining five areas. We can look at a culture and examine its art. Number one, we can examine its art. What do they consider to be beautiful? What do they try to portray and communicate in their art? Secondly, we can look at their music. What music do they listen to? What does it do in the culture? What's its effect? What's its purpose? What's its function? Number three, we can look at their literature. What do they write about? How do they write? Number four, we can examine a culture by the entertainment it enjoys. By the entertainment it enjoys. And number five, we can examine a culture by looking at the education it provides. Careful examination of these five areas will reveal much of what people believe to be true about the nature and purpose of life. When you think about that, what do you consider to be good entertainment? Why? How much? And what does it do? What's its purpose in your life? How much schooling do you need? Should you have? Why? Reveals what you believe to be important. What do you read? What do you listen to? What do you enjoy seeing in art? Our lives will reflect our beliefs. What we do every day at some level reflects our beliefs. And as we said here in this list, music is one of those areas we can examine. And that really is what we want to examine this evening, is the area of music. What is true about music? How do we decide what to listen to? Well, what is music? What is the nature of music? I want to look at some foundations that I believe will help us appreciate and understand good music. Here, everybody turning pages. I'm sorry for the small print on this. I think I was trying to save paper or something. Well, some foundations. Number one, God created the world and called it good. And we've been hearing a lot about this today, but think about it. God created the world, the entire world, everything we see and experience, and he called it good. All, I shouldn't say everything we see and experience, but life, the created order. All of life is sacred. We've heard that today. We must turn away from the dualism that comes when we do not bring the lordship of Jesus Christ to our physical lives as well as our spiritual lives. Music is part of the creation. Music has order and beauty. It's purposeful. It's a gift. And the capacity for making music came to us along with the rest of the created order. We're able to make music. Secondly, we need to remember that we are persons created in the image of God. We bear the very image of God. We can love, feel, think. We have emotions.
Dorothy Sayers, in her book, The Mind of the Maker, acknowledges the complexity of man, but points out that when we turn back to see what the Genesis writer says about the original upon which the image of God was modeled, we find only the single assertion, God created. The characteristic common to God and man is apparently that, the desire and ability to make things. Of course, we know there's a substantive difference between the way God creates and the way we create. God created out of nothing. We can't do that. We cannot create out of nothing. We take what God has given us and we create, whether it's your house, whether it's a painting, whether it's GM making cars, whatever it is, we take what God has given and we create. God created out of nothing. Thirdly, culture and thus music grow out of the creating and subduing activity of man. God told us to subdue and have dominion over the creation. We have an amazing ability and desire to create. Just think in your mind of all the trades, all the gizmos, all the little things, whether it's graffiti on a bridge, everything you see, it's like I get a picture in my mind of people, everybody huddling over something, making something that wasn't created. That's what we're doing. We're forever making something. It's the way we're wired. Nearly everything we experience in life grows out of this creative ability. As Francis Schaeffer emphasizes, it's important to remember this creativity is good. The creativity itself is good. Number four, creativity is good. Nevertheless, not every creation is great art. Nor is everything made by man good, intellectually or morally good. Man is fallen. It's interesting to notice that in Genesis 3, that when we look at the temptation of Eve, one of the things that she noticed was that the fruit was pleasant. It was good to look upon. And we look at God's world, we can say that about a lot of things in God's world. It's pleasant. It's good to look upon. One of the things that I think frightens us about music is that there's so much pleasure in music. And we're not sure what to do with all of that. Because we know we're fallen. And we can see people do bad things with it. And so pleasure seems to be at the very core of the temptation. She saw that it was good, pleasant to look upon. Now, it's interesting that the Apostle John, in 1 John 2, what does he say? The lust of the eyes, the lust of flesh, the lust of the eyes, pride of life. Temptation, as someone has said, has the same tragic, tired ring to it, all through Scripture. It's, again, comes through one of those temptations is pleasure, the lust of the flesh. And I believe it's this point right here that really demands our integrity as we look at music. Alan Bloom, who was a professor at the University of Chicago, I'm not sure if he's still living or not, he wrote The Closing of the American Mind back in 1987. And he talks about the fact, and he's not a Christian as far as I know, but he talks about challenging students in his classrooms to consider their allegiances to music. Of course, he teaches out of Plato and Aristotle, and he wants to emulate the values the Greeks had. And so he wants to call them to something when he talks about beauty and music. And so he said that what they feel when they read Plato's ideas on music is indignation. He says, because whenever the soul is challenged, it's going to feel indignation. And there's loyalty there. And he says to have them be able to step back from their from that loyalty, from their soul, from that indignation, he says, is rare. But he said, once in a while, someone will do that. And he talks about it in almost conversion terms. It's interesting to read what he says there. So I believe we must recognize, since man is fallen, not everything he creates will be good. Creativity itself, as a capacity, is good. I think we can say that, just like I think it was Melvin this morning said, sex is good. We would say that sex is good. We see it twisted all around us. But it was created good. And I think we can say the same thing about the capacity to create. Number five, we are created with a capacity for beauty. Life is more than utilitarian. That's tough on us Mennonites sometimes. remember back in my home community, we had a sound technician come into our gymnasium, and the acoustics were terrible. And he walked in, he walked in the door, looked around, and chuckled. He said, "This is a typical Mennonite building." And it was big. We could seat 600-700 people in that room. But it was the exact worst shape for acoustics. It was twice as long as it was wide. Okay. And we are supremely utilitarian in our approach. We don't have time or money to make anything nice. It's just, what do we need here? Space. Okay. And so we're going to do it. But life is more than utilitarian. The world is overcreated. Step outside this time of year and you can see that it's overcreated. Why so much color? It's just staggering when you stand and look at it. It reflects the ecstasy of Psalm 19 when it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth forth speech, night unto night showeth forth knowledge." I think it's the same emotion when Jesus said, when the disciples were trying to calm and quiet the people, he said, don't make them be quiet. If they're quiet, the very stones are going to cry out. I think the whole creation is there saying, look, can't you see God? And it does it through beauty. The purpose of art, one purpose of art, is to make things real. The piece of art or music is not the real thing. But it images the thing and thus allows us to access the real. Take, for instance, a basic statement, a theological statement, such as God is omniscient. God is all-knowing. Generally, that will not create an impulse or surge of emotion through you. God is omniscient. Yes. Sing a song, look at a painting, consider the mountains, and you might feel that. That's the purpose of beauty. It's important again to remember that the created order is what makes us possible to worship and serve the Creator. Notice that if we reject the created order, if it's somehow bad, we create music using the physical. We create it, whether we sing it, play it, we use the physical world. And so if the physical world is somehow bad, it's going to color the way we look at music. The capacity for beauty is God implanted. Quoting now from Leland Ryken, I believe it's in your notes. "Many of the most worthwhile things in life are of no practical value. Why do people paint the walls of rooms and wear colored clothing? What can a person do in any utilitarian sense with a sunset or a snowy mountain peak or with mists on a summer morning or a beautifully shaped tree?" Well, those are some thoughts, some foundations perhaps, for us to look more closely at music. Let's consider the issue of objectivity. Is there a way to look at music objectively, or is the experience of music unique to every person? I'm wondering if someone could go talk to the children down here. I don't think they're leaving right away. It's hard to talk about the sublime when you have the clamor. Is there a way to look at music objectively? Lewis addresses this just briefly in his little book called The Abolition of Man when he describes two people standing and looking at a waterfall. And the one person comments, stands and looks at it in awe, says, "This is just sublime." The other person says, "Well, what do you mean by sublime?" So that Lewis asks the question now: Is the waterfall sublime by itself? Does it project something that we would call sublime, or was the person just simply describing the feeling inside? What I feel when I look at that is something like sublime, or is it actually that the waterfall communicates the emotion or the feeling or the perception of something that's sublime? In other words, If it's just what I experience and you experience something differently, then we have no basis really to talk about what's good or bad. I can't talk about it because it's very subjective. But if indeed the waterfall is sublime, whether I consider it to be or not, then perhaps we can really be objective about it. Let's think some more about that. Consider the issue of aesthetics. It's a branch of philosophy that deals with the nature of the beautiful and with judgments concerning beauty. The word comes from a Greek word denoting sense perception. Albert Green says that this word and the derivation suggests that what the artist is trying to do, whether in words, colors, sounds, or crafts, is to make us stop and see what we normally do not see. Green goes on to point out that we do not often stop to truly see the world around us. Our lives are so pressured by daily living that we fail to see. We fail to see. Number two, what about the effect of music? Can we agree that music is experienced in similar ways, or is music purely subjective in all that we experience? Is it something qualitatively different between two pieces of music? I've had people tell me they don't feel anything when we listen to a certain piece of music. I might say, wow, doesn't that just stir you to hear that? No, I don't feel anything. Well, my response to people like that is I've talked to a few people that respond that way. And I'm going to be careful not to be judgmental here. But my assessment is that they don't feel very many things at all very deeply. Is that too harsh? They don't feel very many things at all very deeply. They may not be able to cry with a friend. They're not moved by tragedy. Others say, boy, that's terrible. You don't see anything in their face, though, that says this is terrible. It's just sort of this wooden approach to life. They haven't cultivated a sensitivity to music or a number of those things. They often don't feel. They can look at a scene of incredible beauty and say, oh, it's purple. And I see orange, you know. Well, music does affect us. There's general agreement on this. Tempo, dynamics, rhythms, degrees of dissonance, tone qualities, styles of performance vary to make music functional for different purposes. You can talk about the use of music for music therapy, for pain relief. People, of course, if you go into any music store, you'll see CDs that's designed to create some kind of mood, soothing or up-tempo or anything like that. General agreement that some things in music do affect us differently. There is agreement to that. Well, how do we judge it? It's really where it gets more difficult. How do we judge creativity? I mean, it's kind of hard to look at a great painting or listen to a piece of music and to point, especially music. Music is one of the more abstract of the arts. It's just something we hear. We can't see it. We often take up a sheet of music, we say. But the interesting thing is it doesn't really become music until we hear it. Until we hear it. And so it is very abstract. And so to judge something that we can't see, that we can't even feel physically, and to say, that's good, that's bad. How do we do that? I want to say again that we cannot escape the fact that we've been affected by the fall. And again, if pleasure is one of the ways, the primary ways that we're tempted, it's going to be difficult. How do you turn away from something that feels good? It can be done. But wouldn't we all say it's more difficult? If it feels good in some way, it's going to be more difficult. Because in some way, it's tangible to some part of me. Well, Leland Ryken offers several criterion for this kind of discrimination. Number one, he asks the question, what is the purpose that underlies an artist's creative effort? What is the purpose? Maybe you'll have to get to know the artist. Maybe you have to understand a little bit about the cultural context out of which they create. Maybe you'd understand a little bit about what they think is true. But if you spend some time here in the arts, you will begin to be able to discern some of these things, just experiencing whatever it is, whether it's a painting, whether it's a song, whatever it is, you'll begin to discern what that writer or painter or composer thought about what is real and what is true. So what is the purpose? I believe Christianly the purpose needs to be that we serve humanity and we glorify God. It needs to serve humanity and glorify God. That's really the rationale for the carpenter as well, you know. He builds houses for people. You can't get much more fundamental to our existence than the need for shelter. So he serves humanity, and he believes that doing that can bring glory to God. Or at least I hope he does. Because it can. So music, the same way, we can serve humanity, we glorify God. We also talk about the issue of sincerity here. In other words, is the artist being true to himself and his conception of truth, or is he doing this just to make money? Is he doing this to appeal to a certain segment of the culture? And he wants to make money. So we talk about sincerity here as well. What is the purpose? Number two, what is the effect on an audience? And we really have to ask this question in music. What is the effect on the audience? Does it make people more sensible, more human, more moral? Or does it encourage people to behave selfishly, immorally, or coarsely even? Number three, the issue of aesthetic excellence. I want to talk about this some more because here's where people will want to debate a little bit. How do you know, who are you to decide what's beautiful? Is there actually an objective standard here that we can say this is beautiful and this isn't, or this is more beautiful than this is? How do we go about doing that? But the issue of aesthetic excellence, we could talk about technical excellence versus poorly executed technique. I think we'd all agree, and this is one of the, in music especially, the fact that I can pick up a guitar and learn a few chords in a half hour's time and accompany a song, and the song may have wonderful Christian message, but my ability to appreciate that song will be limited somewhat by the poor technique on the guitar. Now, I'm not judging the person playing the guitar or his motives. I'm simply saying the art itself, the music that comes from that, will not be as technically excellent and therefore not as beautiful. Now, he may have a beautiful spirit and desire and intention, and so God may accept his praise. You hear what I'm saying? Okay. But in terms of sheer beauty, it will not be as beautiful as the person who has studied the guitar for 10, 15 years, has played it 3 hours a day, every day, and can play great music on the guitar. Okay, and by the way, professionals, they practice more like 4 to 6 hours a day on that. So the issue of aesthetic excellence. I want to say that the art form may actually detract from the Christian message, even though the message is excellent. The art form could actually detract. It doesn't need to negate it or wipe it out. I'm not saying that you sitting on your back porch and humming a tune or strumming your guitar or playing a harmonica can't be praised and it can't be beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm only saying it won't be as beautiful. One way you can look at that is if you went and recorded that, half hour after you learned to play guitar, you record it and tried to market it, what would happen? Wouldn't work. Why not? There's not enough enduring appeal. It's not beautiful enough to last that long to put it on tape. Okay? It won't sell. Well, let's talk some more about the issue of taste. And I've subtitled this aesthetic sensibility. Aesthetic sensibility. Again, the issue of what is beautiful. So, taste is cultivated. Taste is cultivated. And again, I want to remind you, we're not evaluating whether or not God can accept this or whether it's right or wrong in the sense that it's that if God were to judge me at that moment in that he would cast it off as being morally wrong and the other being morally right. What I'm talking about is what we enjoy. Just let me explain a little bit. Take photography or art. Take the pictures of your last birthday party for your 3-year-old. or let's say your one-year-old, whether you let him smash and pound the cake, okay? Wonderful. We all delight in it. We laugh. We take lots of pictures. And then we go get it blown up into about 16 by 24, and we put a frame around it, put it on a living room wall, right? No, we don't. Why not? Why don't we put the latest snapshot of the last birthday party on our living room wall? That's beautiful. I mean, there's one. I love my child. Most important thing in my life. Why don't I blow it up and put it on the living room wall? Let me suggest to you, it's not enduring enough. It's not beautiful enough. It does not provide the satisfaction or the pleasure that a beautiful landscape or a still life or even a wonderful portrait painting might give that you put on your living room wall. It's the issue of taste. Now, there may be variations between those. What you like on your living room wall, I may not like. Okay? But does that mean that what you like is the best thing and that it's purely a matter of my desire versus your desire? I don't think so. Take the issue of food. How's come we don't live on Big Macs and French fries? Besides the fact that we know it's not good for us. Well, isn't there something aesthetically appealing about a wonderful meal? Some steak and baked potato and salad and all, by the way, done up with a beautiful tablecloth, a few candles, and a few close friends. Take the issue of reading, our reading habits. We may read the daily newspaper, we may read our Bible, we may even enjoy an occasional reading in Shakespeare, we might like an occasional novel. My guess is, even if you love Shakespeare, you won't read him every day. You enjoy a little bit of what we call leisure reading. Okay? But all reading is going to bring some pleasure. That's a fundamental component of reading. We enjoy reading, whether it's a newspaper, a good book, inspirational reading, or a good novel. But again, we like diversity. But just because this is heavy over here doesn't mean it's I spurn it. And you know, there's an elitism that kind of goes both ways there. You know, we may spurn the Shakespeare and the great paintings and say, well, that's, I don't know who they think they are. They think that stuff's so great. And this is good enough for me. It communicates, you know, it's what I like. Okay, but I'm suggesting that we like a variety. Okay, we like a variety. I want to apply that just a little bit in music then later on as well, that we like a variety. So taste is cultivated. There's variety in what we enjoy. Now, I think I have point number C or something in there. We're going to skip that and we're going to come to that at the end. Let's go on to music as cultural expression. Music as cultural expression. I'd like to have us think about how music has developed over time and what people thought about music and how music took shape in the hands of those who had specific thoughts about its purpose and function. The Greeks thought music exemplified the cosmos and corresponded to it. In other words, just like math, there are observable laws, and they thought music as well corresponded to reality. Alan Bloom, in his book, The Close of the American Mind, says, Plato discussed music and thought it had political and social implications. He taught that rhythm and melody, accompanied by dance, are the barbarous expression of the soul. Barbarous, not animal. What he means by barbarous there is that it's just uncultivated. It's just the raw stuff. It just hasn't been tamed or cultivated or nurtured. Music is the medium of the human soul in its most ecstatic condition of wonder and terror. In short, Plato and Aristotle both thought that music shaped the person. Listen to the wrong kind of music, become the wrong kind of person. Listen to the right kind of music, become the right kind of person. That's what they thought. Secondly, let's look at what the church thought. The church, through the work of Augustine and others who had borrowed from Greek philosophy, took on a dualistic view of the created order. And we've heard that all day. Thus, music was a very sensual, and I don't mean by that sexual simply mean that it's sense-oriented. We experience it physically. Music in the mind of the early church was very sensual art and needed to be guarded carefully. Now remember, they had already bought in the idea that the spiritual was somehow higher and perhaps not quite fully connected to the physical. And so music being in the created realm, they were going to be a little cautious about it. Plus, it was that old pleasure issue. And what do we do with the pleasure? Especially if you start thinking that the physical is suspect. If it brings pleasure, then I'm going to question it. Augustine said one quote, and I wasn't able to find this, but just to paraphrase, he says, "When I hear the carefully modulated voice of the trained singer, I have to guard myself because I feel the pleasure that it produces." And so he was very suspicious of that pleasure. Well, jumping ahead, we come to the Enlightenment. And with the Enlightenment came the renewed emphasis on man as man. So now we had this turning toward the physical, the reals. With the increased emphasis on reason, the problem of dualism was again not addressed, and separation between the spiritual and physical broadened. Pleasure, whether enjoyed through the arts or other areas of life, was enjoyed more outside the church than in it. The church viewed pleasure with suspicion. And that's whether the arts, not all kinds of areas there. Well, we move and move ahead again, and we come to the Romantics in the 19th century. The Romantics were disillusioned with the rational. This is coming on the heels of Mozart, Haydn, Bach, Handel, and all those. They wanted to express the deep emotions and desires of the human heart, as well as the mystical forces in nature. Even as science and other ideas took hold in the broader society, the composers in the Romantic period were reaching out to the supernatural. They wanted to experience something in the supernatural. And they thought that nature, there was something mystical about nature, and they reached out to that and felt some kinship there with the inner life that they experienced. And so Donald J. Grout, in his book, The History of Western Music, History of Music in the Western World, the music of this period is constantly thrusting beyond the borders of the rational into the unconscious and supernatural. So music began to change, and Beethoven is seen kind of as the big bridge here between these two, even though they dip into Mozart and Haydn a bit as well. But Beethoven is seen as the bridge. One person described his music as being too much given to the, I can't remember the words now, I didn't write this down, but to the impulses, the emotional impulses. In other words, musically, he jumped around too much. In other words, it wasn't quite as harnessed to reason. The 19th century also saw a tremendous tremendous increase in population, with most of it occurring in the cities. People no longer lived in communities where just they could just go on a short walk to the countryside. And no longer did everyone know everyone else. And instead, they were lost in an impersonal, huddled mass. As Donald Grout says, the more man's daily life became separated from nature, the more he became enamored with nature. It was during this time that the idea developed that music had a history of its own. Again, Mr. Grout says, the Romantic movement had from the beginning a revolutionary tinge, with a corresponding emphasis on the virtue of originality in art. Romanticism was seen as revolt against the limitations of classicism. And that, would have been the music of Mozart and others. I believe the church's inability to address the schism here between the heart and the mind, between the spiritual and the physical, was a direct result of that old dichotomy we've been talking about all day, that man can't get together. And the church was not able to address this. I had a voice teacher one time who told me that we're going to save the world through the arts. Of course, I said, how are we going to do that? Oh, I don't know. She said, well, I didn't either. But people really believed that. The Romantic artists of the early 19th century regarded the imagination as the religious faculty by which people have contact with the supernatural. Notice what they began to do was worship the aesthetic experience. They began to worship beauty. Beauty called forth such emotion and power that they began to worship the sense and the response to beauty and thought that was a religious experience. Again, witness the power of pleasure and beauty. Well, we come then to three, especially two very important people, Wagner, the composer, Richard Wagner, and the philosopher Nietzsche, and then a composer again, Schoenberg. Now, these three men represent a progression in music and thought. And it's interesting that Nietzsche, along with Rousseau, Nietzsche was a musician. He was gifted enough as a pianist that he could have gone on to be a concert pianist and a composer, in fact. But he chose instead to study philosophy. And Nietzsche's whole life really is a tragedy. He was the son of a Lutheran pastor. And it was Nietzsche, if you recall, that proclaimed, "God is dead." He went to an opera at about age 20, 21, and it had been written by Wagner, and it was an opera called Tristan und Isolde. And without going into a lot of detail, let me just say that this opera was unique in that Wagner was trying to communicate something in the way that he wrote the music. And it was different music in that no longer did you have melody beginning, rising to a climax, and descending to some sort of resolution. All within a phrase, we call it, in music. Whether it's two-measure phrase, four-measure phrase, or a series of phrases, building to a climax and then letting you down. Well, this was what they thought music subjugated to reason, pure reason, and they hated it. They felt it was the soul, an expression of the primary problem with society of that day. And so Wagner composed this opera. Well, let me describe it as Michael Jones in his book, Dionysus Rising, The Birth of Cultural Revolution Out of the Spirit of Music. He describes the effect of the opera as follows. Emotions were strained in one direction, and before they could be resolved into the initial key, they headed off in the direction of another key to be strained again. Now, what he's talking about here, even in our hymn books, we have little modulations. We change keys in the middle of the song, and we'll have a cadence in a different key than what we started out with. But we'll always end in the original key that we began. Okay? Well, what Wagner did in this opera was change that. Once you left a key, you may never go back, at least not till a long time later, and you may go through a number of other keys. And what he did is he elevated this, and he did it by using chromaticism, which is like if you would play all the keys on the piano, you know, white and black in a row, you have a chromatic scale, 12 of them. So what he did is by using a lot of chromaticism and modulating techniques, he made this music so that it never lets you down. Now, this is radical stuff back in the late 1800s. This is very radical. And it stirred. In fact, there were riots at some of these concerts because people left so stirred up that they didn't know what to do with their emotions. Now, it didn't help matters. On the stage was being acted out was a love story. Okay? Didn't help matters any. But what we have to notice is that there have been love stories in operas for 150, 200 years already. It wasn't the love story being played out in front of them that made them go bonkers, if you'll excuse the word. What it was is the music elevated the emotions and kept them there and never let them down. So it was a continual pump musically. Jones goes on to say, the chromatic modulations could now allow the musical movement to drift from one key to another in a seemingly endless orgy of sensual emotion, unchecked by either the principles of the moral law or the exigencies of the diatonic scale. They left the diatonic scale. There was no resolution. Nietzsche loved it. He called it the lust of hell. Now, he probably didn't mean hell quite the way you and I do. But what he was wanting to do was a complete overthrow of the values and the social structures of his time. It's interesting to note that Wagner, as a young man, was involved in an attempted overthrow of the government. That revolution failed. He nearly spent some time in jail for it, could have gotten in trouble, managed to escape the problem, and decided that the only way to accomplish cultural revolution was through music. And the way to do that was to, the way to overthrow a society is through sex. Now, this sounds so bald and bold that you probably think this is crazy. Come on, it's got to be more complex than that. But that's really what they said. Wagner was a philosopher as well as a musician, and we have his writings. But they talked about the will to power. The will to power. What that simply meant was that reason was what kept desire in check in people, was reason. And ever since the Greeks, we've been using reason to keep desire in check and to balance it. Well, the philosopher Schopenhauer, and along with Wagner and Nietzsche and others, talked about the will to power and that will somehow being the desire. So this desire actually superseded the idea of truth. In fact, they said that desire is somehow ultimate truth. And that desire, they said, included sexual desire. Nietzsche saw in Wagner someone with the ability to write music that would accomplish a revolution. And for both of them, Michael Jones says, desire, I already said that, is in some sense ultimate truth. Reason is the antithesis of desire, according to them, and reason should now become subject to music. In his book, Nietzsche wrote, the name of the book was The Birth of Tragedy, Out of the Spirit of Music. Nietzsche portrays Socrates as the villain in the cultural history of the West. According to Nietzsche, Socrates banished the spirit of music from tragedy because of his desire to subordinate life to reason. Notice the word, subordinate life. Nietzsche said people are dead. They're not even fully human. And Nietzsche had something pertinent to say to us in that issue there. Not everything he said was about the sexual component, but he was talking about people being people and who they were created to be, and somehow... I'm not doing very well with this, but somehow they had been diminished as persons. Music is so powerful, Nietzsche believed, that even when articulate speech is added, it is utterly subordinate to and determined by the music and the passions it expresses. I don't know about you, but 10 years ago, I wouldn't have liked that statement. I didn't buy it. That's what he said. To be sure, the church in Europe at this time was somewhat compromised. It was on the defensive. Nietzsche had not experienced true Christianity, had not grown up seeing it. He didn't experience a church that could speak powerfully into the needs and issues of the day. He was ripe for the influence of Wagner. Wagner viewed the art of the Greeks to be superior to the art of the life-denying and hypocritical Christians. And I'm almost through with this. Stick with me. Wagner says, Christianity adjusts the ills of an honorless, useless, and sorrowful existence of mankind on earth by the miraculous love of God, who had not, as the noble Greeks supposed, created man for a happy and self-conscious life upon this earth, but had here imprisoned him in a loathsome dungeon, so as, in reward for the self-contempt that pointed him therein, to prepare him for a posthumous state of endless comfort. In other words, after death. After death, he'd experience endless comfort and inactive ecstasy. Notice Wagner was repelled by that idea. We're just going to sit in heaven, walk on streets of gold, and praise God the rest of eternity. Therefore, the poor wretch, who in the enjoyment of his natural powers made this life his own possession, must suffer after death the eternal torments of hell. Naught was required of mankind but faith. That is to say, the confession of its miserable plight, and giving up of all spontaneous attempt to escape from out of this misery for the undeserved, italicized, undeserved grace of God. He couldn't stand that. Was alone to set it free. So he felt like man had just become a pawn. Nietzsche says, and this quote is in your handout, and I think this is a tremendous quote. If these Christians want me to believe in their God, they'll have to sing me better songs. They'll have to look more like people who have been saved. They'll have to wear on their countenance the joy of the Beatitudes. I could only believe in a God who dances. That ought to cause us to weep at some point. He was right. He really was right. Christianity that in that day had lost all of those things he was talking about. He's talking our language there. Well, Schoenberg came along. And because he had lost his wife to another man, among some other reasons, was repulsed. And he had been a student of Wagner and Nietzsche, by the way. But he composed a 12-tone row in music. And it's the antithesis of tonality as well. So in some sense, it grows out of the, in musically, it grows out of what Wagner was doing. However, it is totally, if I can use the word, unphysical. What you simply did at the 12-tone row is you took 12 tones, 12 pitches, not necessarily in order, but you just picked out 12 tones and you put them in a row. And once you had them in that row, they were always in that order. Then you composed your music using those 12 tones. Now you could do a couple things with it. You could reverse the order, because they would still be adjacent, you see. You could reverse the order of the row. Or instead of going up to the next pitch, you could take that interval and go down. So you could reverse it that way. Or you could do both. You could reverse the row and reverse the inversion and do the inversion. Okay? But it's very simple compared to composing music. I mean, you could just about go do it if you thought about it a little bit and took what I just gave you. Well, what happened is there was a proliferation of German composers using this technique, but it died out. There was not enough creativity there. It was no beauty. It's horrible stuff to hear. When the public rejected it, couldn't listen to it, the intellectuals kind of liked it because of what it was saying. The public, general populace, couldn't handle it. They didn't want to listen to it. And so when they rejected it, Nietzsche, toward the end of his life, made this statement. If that dissonance isn't going to work, this is uncannily prophetic. He said he predicted the rise of an African sensibility. Now, we know where rhythm in rock music comes from. It comes from Africa. Everybody would agree to that. It comes from Africa. I don't want to say that as a racial statement. I'm not saying that against blacks, but I'm simply saying that Nietzsche called it an African sensibility. He predicted the rise. He says that's what's going to accomplish the cultural revolution. That's what's going to overthrow everything. Nietzsche, even at the end of his life, when he went insane, never gave up on seeing it happen. Well, you and I have seen it happen. I want to talk a little bit about rock and roll. Here's where we want to try to bring this together. A number of cultural forces at work here, but by the 1960s, we know what happened. We had the rock concerts. We had the riots. We had the violence at concerts. Mick Jagger and others saying that rock music is about rebellion, pure rebellion. Others said it's about sex and rebellion. They would walk on stage. Some of them would walk on stage with puppies. And the audience would be worked up to a fever pitch, and they would make the audience promise to kill the puppy if they threw it out. They'd throw the puppy out, and the audience would dismember it, just rip it apart. Now, I don't know how that strikes you, but that strikes me as fundamentally evil. Fundamentally evil. Now, the thing is, at the concerts, Mick Jagger at the Altamont concert in California, when the Hell's Angels were there beating people with their pool poles, their lead-filled pool poles, as people rushed the stage trying to get to the performers to mob them because they were so worked up, so frenzied, they would beat them with the poles. And twice, Mick Jagger stopped and said, hey, do we have to do that to people? Okay, do we have to do that? But he couldn't stop it. So what did he do? He tried to start singing again, singing the music that brought the audience to that point. And so he stopped again. Eventually, the mob rushed the stage. They dropped their instruments and ran to the waiting helicopters and got out. And they watched the mob literally tear apart an automobile that had been sitting right there next to the helicopter. They said it was like watching Beatles over something and just ripping it to shreds. Now, if your reaction is like mine, if you like contemporary Christian music that has the rock style, we were talking about this over supper, you know, some CD jackets still have it. This group sounds like Led Zeppelin, or this sounds like Pink Floyd, or, you know, they imitate the style. If you still like contemporary music, you're going to fight what we're saying and what the implications are. And you're saying, well, they don't have those riots anymore at concerts, okay? So are you sure it's the music that's doing it? Maybe something bad just happened. Well, and I would even be willing to agree that if you and I went and sat and heard Wagner's opera that I talked about that caused some riots and some stir, you and I would not feel the pull towards sexuality that those people felt, simply because it was so radically different and new. So there we have some conditioning. People argue, the issue of music, they'll argue that it's conditioned response. Okay? You're just not used to it. That's not what it communicates to me. Listen to the lyrics. Okay? This is wonderful music. Okay? Well, I would agree that there's some conditioning going on. And I used to, in my arguments with my dad, I used to say, you know, the text is actual scripture. You know? And I was convicted because I felt constrained to obey my dad, and I wasn't obeying him. He'd wanted me to get rid of it all, and I hadn't. And the lyrics would convict me. I'd listen to my groups, and the lyrics would convict me about listening to this kind of music, simply because I wanted to obey my dad. Okay, now, of course, I'm out of the realm of music here a little bit now in that discussion, but I just say that to say that I think I would agree with people that there is some conditioned response here, that we can sort of steel ourselves against what the music calls for. But what I'm going to argue is that the music itself is still a sense-oriented. It's sensual in that sense, that it is still going to appeal primarily to the physical. And because we're out of time, I just want to make some statements here. In fact, I want to read one more quote here from Alan Bloom, who was writing in 1987, well after the 60s. College professor meeting a lot of students. He says, rock music has one appeal only, a barbaric appeal to sexual desire. Not love, not eros, but sexual desire, undeveloped and untutored. Rock gives children on a silver platter, with all the public authority of the entertainment industry, everything their parents always used to tell them they had to wait for until they grew up and would understand later. He continues, the inevitable corollary of such sexual interest is rebellion against parental authority that represses it. Selfishness thus becomes indignation and then transforms itself into morality. Do you hear that? Come on, Dad, I like my music. This isn't bad. And I get indignant. And it's transformed into morality. The sexual revolution must overthrow all the forces of domination, the enemies of nature and happiness. From love comes hate, masquerading as social reform. A worldview is balanced on the sexual fulcrum. I'd just like to share a little bit of my testimony. I've already given some of it. But like I said, I used to listen to a lot of contemporary music. It wasn't the really hard stuff, but I listened to it. And I remember after I got out of college, in college and studying music, I found myself less and less attracted to it just because I began to recognize it a lower form of excellence and artistic aesthetic appeal, just from the aesthetic side. I began to see it was a much simpler form of music. While it had immediate appeal, it didn't have enduring appeal. That's why the top 40 chart is changing endlessly. It doesn't last very long. You got to have something new. Okay? Well, I got to college, worked for a while, and then began teaching, which is work too, by the way. And that first year that I taught, you know, first year teaching does this to you. You get immersed in what you need to do, and it takes you to the edge of who you are and what you know. So in that whole experience, in relating to young people and their problems and their needs, I hardly had time to listen to music. I didn't, except what we did in choir, okay, in school. I hardly had time to listen to it. And so I left my contemporary music on the shelf for about 6, 8, 9 months. Well, we went on a senior trip that first year, and the senior said, hey, can we play this in the... I looked at it, oh, sure, I have that at home. I stuck it in. And I couldn't believe, I suddenly realized what I had... sort of scorned all up to that time. I had scorned the idea that if you want to test your music, put it away for a while and then come back and listen to it after. What I wanted to do, and if you'll excuse me, I wanted to unbutton my second button and I wanted to stick my head out the window and just chill out. Now, that wasn't necessarily sexual. It wasn't. But it was physical. You see that? It was just something, you know. I just wanted to hang out a little bit. Chill out. Well,
It was the first time, and it happened by accident. It was the first time that I was willing to say, okay, maybe there's something to this. Okay. Now, I know if you're committed to contemporary music, you're going to take my testimony and say, I don't buy. Because I did it. I just challenge you to consider that some of the issues that we talked about, in that it's all about cultural revolution. And I challenge you to ask yourself, is the revolution continuing? No question. Kenneth Myers says in his book that rock music is the idiom of popular culture. The idiom, that means it's what talks. Okay, it communicates popular culture. I don't know how we can set out on our CD labels to copy exactly what's out there when it's about rebellion and cultural overthrow and copy it, put Christian lyrics to it and say, it's good. I can't do it. Well, what about the fact, what always happens in music? Now, let's consider something else that happens in music. Whenever you have, there is an evolution to music, maybe an evolvement would be better, or a development in music. We started with Gregorian chant, and then we went to some of the Renaissance polyphony, and then we had Bach, and then we have Handel's Messiah, and then we move on up through the other people I talked about tonight. Not all of them were using music as a specific way to change the way people thought or experienced life. Many of them were simply using music out of what it appeared to be true to reality, true to nature, what it appeared to do as you toyed with it, created it. I'm not sure how to say that. But something different happened with these people that we discussed tonight. They began to see music a power to do something else. And they twisted it. They took the forms we still use, rhythm, harmony, and they just twisted them. And then they used the repetition and less sense of tonality, which means less sense of order and symmetry, less sense of purpose and direction. And as we heard today, the culture is all, they don't have purpose, don't have direction. That's why rock music speaks to it. Now, the fact is that even some of the choruses you probably sing a cappella in your church once in a while came out of folk rock or the rock scene. Okay, so we have a development. We only can sing what we hear. Isn't that right? You can't just, if I ask you, sing like they do over in India. So excuse me, I haven't heard anything like that. I can't compose a song like they use pitches in India. But I do hear, walking down the street, the fact that I listened to it for 3 or 4 years, my children hear it. They go uptown, spend time with the people who may listen to it, have family members maybe that listen to it all the time. That language becomes part of my musical language, my musical vocabulary. And I will begin, if I hum or sing, I will begin to reflect that, reflect what I hear. So what makes it difficult here is it feels like there's a big gray area, because just little touches of it here or there get put in. And so we think, well, if it's a cappella, it can't be rock or it can't be bad. Or, well, what do we do with that? I want to say that I think we need to have a great deal of patience, sensitivity to people who are somewhere on that journey of deciding what's good to listen to and what isn't. And I know what my line is. See, I've tried to establish an overall absolute here. But if I come to the middle of that circle, there's going to be some give and take. And it's going to depend on things like my sensitivity aesthetically, my sensitivity spiritually, what I've grown up listening to. All of those things are going to impact what I choose or what I say is okay or good for me to listen to. And so I want to say, how do we decide? We must grow in the grace and knowledge of Jesus Christ, obviously. We have to grow in that knowledge. I think we have to be committed to an unrelenting integrity about what music does to us. I think we can enjoy music to incredible levels of bliss and delight. And it doesn't just have to be classical. Okay? But we have to be committed to unrelenting integrity, and I think we need, as we heard this morning, we need the body of Christ in that as well. Well, let's talk about other music. What about the crooners? Someone asked, what about the crooners of the 50s, you know? Well, what I would say there again, it was a very emotional form of music. It's very emotional. It appeals to the emotions. Again, it's, I think, out of balance. What about country and western? I think country is all about sentimentalism. Someone said that sentimentalism is loving something more than God does. I like that definition. Again, but let me say again, on even on country and western, I've appreciated some of that. I don't buy any of it. I don't go out of my way to listen to it, but you hear it. I've appreciated some of that because of its authenticity about the human experience. Remember what Nietzsche's criticism was about the church. We're not real people. We're somber. We want to go to heaven. And we're, it's a terrible place. This earth is bad. Well, you know, we could say some jokes about country music, but it's authentic. It's authentic. Some very honest people there, more honest than a lot of Christians. The Bible says to listen to psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. It's pretty broad, really. Sing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. I know people, I have friends and family who will worship God to praise and worship music. And again, I think about that. Well, there is not the intensity of the unrelenting beat that was true of those Rolling Stones concerts. There's not the unrelenting intensity. There's not the shrieking and the yelling and the screaming, but there's a little bit of it. And I still say it appeals more to the physical than what it ought to. And so I'm gonna say that it's not the best, and it may not even be right. But again, I know people who love the Lord, who are giving their entire lives to serve God, and they're helping people. God has blessed their ministry. It's effective. I cannot say you are not a believer. And that's what they listen to. I'm going to have to be gracious and promote what in my home and family, what I believe to be true and right. I have to let God decide about that. I think they can be Christians. I really do. I think they're sacrificing something. I think you could even listen to some popular ballads. I had an old bishop come to me, a man I respect very well, very conservative man. I was surprised. He says, Brandon, what do you think about, you know, some of those love songs that you hear? You know, do you really think they're wrong? And I said, well, I have thought about that. I would enjoy singing that to my wife, you know. And he says, well, good. I'm glad you feel that way. He said, I want us to hear that music itself is not bad. It's part of the created order. I want us to hear that pleasure is a fundamental way that we've been tempted and led away into evil, into the distortions. And I want us to hear that we need to have integrity before God, ourselves, and other people. Let me talk in closing on this little quote, I believe it's in your notes, on the idea of pleasure. In the book, Reclaiming the Future of Education, Christian Education, A Transforming Vision by Albert Green, he says, C.S. Lewis thanks his friend for helping him to learn the far more secret doctrine that pleasures are shafts of the glory as it strikes our sensibility. Pleasure does not come in the final sense from a tasty delicacy, a cool drink on a hot day, or a heartwarming conversation with a dear friend. Pleasure comes through these, not from them. Only God makes pleasures. At thy right hand are pleasures forevermore. Every good gift comes down from the Father of lights. They are direct touches from God himself on our hearts, mediated by things or people in the creation. Mediated by things or people in the creation. The devil misuses pleasures. He does not make them. What are your comments, questions? Yes.
The music of Johann Sebastian Bach, who created Wagner by Liszt. What are you, and who wrote tremendous church music, very dedicated to the Lord.
But what?
Was very dedicated to the Lord.
Okay, yes.
And wrote, as it says in our book here, to own God.
Right.
Do you find his music to be pleasurable? I was just at a recital, an organ recital of Bach, where for an hour and a half I sat, spellbound, spine tingling. I would describe it as pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something wrong with that?
I don't think so, because I don't believe he created the music to do bad things. I think he was just exploring the possibilities. Within, it has purpose, it has direction, it has balance. It didn't take you off into an endless, as this quote said, endless orgy of emotion. It is very emotional music. I think we're scared of our emotions. I think we wonder what's going to happen when we start feeling this good. But again, especially if you have some innate distrust of the physical, which we ought to be. Obviously, we're going to be alert and discerning. We're fallen. But as redeemed people, I think we can experience that kind of beauty. I know there's going to be dispute on that. I for one, don't think it's bad. I will say this. I have a hard time. I went one time to hear the St. Matthew's Passion by Bach. I personally have not listened to Bach's music enough to be able to sit through a three-hour program of that and to be glued to it the entire time. I find my mind wandering and I stretch a time or two. Now, there's people that haven't been trained as well as I have who can. They'll sit right through that and love every minute of it. And again, I think it's a matter of cultivation. It's cultivated. The ability to appreciate it. We would all appreciate a well-crafted house as compared to a little shack. But we don't want to apply that same thing to music. We want something that's instantly accessible, and that's popular culture. Microwaves, you name it. Any other questions? Yes. I'm glad you brought that up. I skipped that in my notes. People will say, well, Mozart was a brat as a child, and certainly a pagan as an older person. How's come was he able to write such beautiful music, and what makes his music right and the music of today wrong? Or they'll say, hey, Luther borrowed from the local folk songs and barroom tunes to write his hymns. But I think if you heard what I was saying tonight, you recognize that's a different argument. That music was not written or created for cultural revolution. It was written as they understood the nature of reality. And it was a more or less Christian understanding of reality. That's what it grew out of. All of Western music. Every study of Western music will begin in the chant in the Catholic Church. We'll study the Greeks, but we begin with the chant. And so I would just say that that's not the same argument. The fact that I can take a folk tune or a barroom melody and put good words to it is the same thing as taking a top hit by Led Zeppelin and putting Christian words to it. It's different. And I know I refuse to accept that for years, but that's where I'm coming out.
Mm-hmm. And certain, it seems to me like a narrowing of the scope to focus on the elements.
Right.
I'm wondering creatively here about using music for the glory of God, for the proper growth of Christ's kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
What are the? How can we broaden our ability to communicate musically with a fuller spectrum components?
It's an excellent question. Yeah, Bloom says that rock music is the language of today's culture. And he says nothing else speaks. And you put a classical CD in and they say, what's this? Okay, and it doesn't speak. You understand? One reason you like your music is it communicates something as you understand it. And so how do we go about, do we just yank the guy in off the street and say, you're listening to terrible, lousy, rotten music. Listen to this. Doesn't this bring you to worship? I guarantee you it won't. He might think it's sublime after a time because he likes the people and they're wonderful people and, wow, you guys have such great music. But it's not really, if you talk to him when he's back home, he'll put his music in. At least at certain times because it speaks. So it's an excellent question. I'm not sure I have a good answer. I'm troubled by it as well. I don't think I want to be heard as saying that we all need to listen to Mozart and we'll be godly. Again, music has an evolution. I think we do need to think about how music is according to nature, the way it was created to be. And we have to say, how does it affect me? But I don't think that means I can never use any dissonance in my music, or I can't even use a very rhythmic piece. Now, some people have said, well, rock music is about rhythm. We want no rhythm. We don't want anybody tapping their foot. We don't want any display of rhythm. I think that's a misunderstanding of the problem. So I would, another comment about psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. When the church emphasized only the high church music, the formal Latin mass, and the populace didn't understand it, they tended toward dead formalism, tended toward it. Now, there were always pockets of people who were sincere, I'm sure. But generally, they tended toward dead formalism. When they went totally toward the immediate expression of, you know, God is so good, or, you know, if that was their only diet, they tended toward heresy, and because it was based on experience. And it wasn't rooted in historical church or in scripture and so on. So I think we need a broad spectrum. We need the old hymns. We need Mozart and Bach. We need the praise choruses. We need all kinds. And I think we can benefit from them. I've heard some popular ballads that I think have melodies that would be perfectly accessible. It is like Francis Schaeffer says, and he would not say that rock music is bad. But he said if you're playing to an audience and you're playing rock music as an art form, I'm quoting him roughly here now. He says you better get some feedback from the audience. Did they actually hear the Christian message, the worldview, or did they hear something else? And I'm suggesting that's why, as one public school student told me, his dad took him to Amy Grant concerts. I said, well, what'd your dad say about the Amy Grant concert? He said, you never seen so many queers in one place in his life. Now, I think there's such a thing as the world being enticed to our authenticity and offering something. I'm not saying hippies should never be enticed into our worship services or our singing programs. They ought to be enticed by something. But if the world never feels any affront, if they never feel a call to anything different, they can listen to Amy Grant, listen to Led Zeppelin, they can listen to whoever. I have a problem. There's a big problem there, I think. I don't know. Did you have thoughts on that, Anthony?
I was thinking in terms of leading people out of the rock culture. And I don't suggest that
right.
Music is the primary way to do that. But mm-hmm. I was also thinking in terms of a full expression of worship.
Yes.
You know, have we been reduced by the constraints of our sin?
Yeah. I would feel we have. The other, and maybe some of you have some comments on this. I think I would want to give a person time to develop another musical language. I think I'd want to give him time to do that. Just like I would give him time to grow in any other area of his Christian experience. I don't know how that would look. Again, take a lot of discernment. I'd want to be talking to good brothers and sisters, you know, but I think we have to have some grace there. Maybe someone else has a comment on that.
Being in a rock and roll band for about 4 years. about that subject of music because I really struggled with that. Mm. Somebody talked to me about it, and I was like, it's different for me because I'm a musician.
Mm.
And I love music. And it's different for me than everybody else because they don't understand music the way I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a different scripture where it says, it is better to hear the music of the wise than the song of the fool.
Mm.
You know, it says, we need it to be for teaching and admonishing one another.
Mm.
Psalms.
Mm.
So the Lord told me the music should teach in your music and admonish people.
Mm-hmm.
And in Psalm 40, verse 3, I think it says, and he has put a new song within my heart, praise unto God.
Mm.
So he showed me that the music should be directly praising the Lord. And by the scriptures, my spirit and everything, every part of my life changed, the music and everything. But it took a while.
Yeah. And I appreciate you sharing that, Jason, because what I hear him saying is a heart turned toward God and listening. You know, one other thing that I experienced was that my high school groups often, I knew what they were listening to. And after a year or two on choir, they would say, you know, I just don't like that stuff anymore. Okay? So I think there's a development, yes.
So practically speaking, coming from, I'm very musically illiterate.
Okay.
In the music that I listened to in my life, that was primarily, we would say, rock and roll. What practically, how does the church help someone like me? You know, how do you develop that in musical life? How do you come to appreciate music as beauty because it relates to things as they really are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have to learn music to do that?
No. Just exposure. I used to play classical music in my classroom when we had an individualized curriculum, and we used to play that. First students, what is that? You know. By the end of a couple of years of that, they would say, hey, can we put that one on? I just think it's exposure.
I would agree. Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be my best. Exposure. I mean, I would never be able to articulate it, but it did seem to me that something was amiss in that style of music. So I disciplined my listening early on in my Christian life, and the taste developed. I didn't know if that's a legitimate practical.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, it has to be developed. Anyone else? Yes. Jazz is unique in that what happened was it developed out of a combination of classical music and an African rhythm. And so the argument of complexity fits for jazz. It's very it has the complexity of classical music. Good jazz does. But
that's not an oxymoron.
No. But I've had to be. I know for me personally, I have very little of it. I do have a little bit of it. For instance, I have a CD that where it takes a number of pieces by Bach and puts them on synthesizer. It has some of the pieces have a subtle jazz feel to it. I've had that CD for several years. I have on occasion now just blipped that one or two pieces that I think had what I just wasn't comfortable listening to it. Now you understand, I feel some resentment that I feel I need to do that sometimes. You hear me struggling with my integrity a little bit there? I mean, I somehow have to make a decision before God what He's calling me to. I'm not going to say that it has to be the same place for you, but it does take away, there is a lot of variety, there's not the intensity, driving rhythm that rock pours at you. I think it is more sensual. Again, sense-oriented, not just sexual. Okay, thank you very much.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.